So I wanted to this morning discuss a topic of Yerushalayim, but not Yerushalayim as it pertains to the Six-Day War, as much as the history of Yerushalayim and a lot of the political jockeying and a lot of the issues that came up that led to what eventually happened with Yerushalayim on the Six-Day War, that led to the situation of Jordanian control over the eastern part of Yerushalayim, that led to the very difficult but and weighty but ultimately successful decision of the Israeli army in 1967 to take Yerushalayim in its offensive against operation against Jordan, which liberated Yerushalayim and united it for the Jewish people for the first time in thousands of years. Okay, so the first part of this is just a general timeline. Page one is just a general timeline of Yerushalayim. It's important to have this historical context. When we first, the first shiur that we gave in this Sunday morning series, which was on Zionism, the first four-part series was on Zionism. So we spoke about different parts of different justifications for the reestablishment of Medinat Yisrael, and one of the things that we discussed was the varying approaches that were taken already in the Yilat Ha'atzmaut, the Israeli Declaration of Independence, and as far as the Zionism goes, just philosophically throughout the history of modern Zionism, they range from safety and security of the Jewish people, which was probably the more understood and more accepted approach throughout the world, you know, that because in post-Holocaust world, the Jewish people garnered much sympathy. But in the opening line of the Israeli Declaration of Independence, and what you hear from, depending on the political bend, what you hear from politicians still today, Medinat Yisrael, is a 3,000-year-old claim to the land of Israel, 3,000-year-old claim to Yerushalayim. That's a big part of what Tzionut is. And the prevailing theme back then, what Ben-Gurion was very much pushing forward, which we'll see in documented evidence in a few minutes, what David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Medinat Yisrael, was very much emphasizing was the fact that there could not be a state of Israel without a Yerushalayim. There could not be a Medinat Yisrael that was in keeping with the core of what Zionism was in the 20th century without Yerushalayim sitting at its heart, being the center of government, being the center of religion. It is the center of Judaism and has been a place that we have been davening to for thousands of years. It has been the center of our focus for so long. And in fact, when the Aliyot of the late 19th and early 20th century started, the main focus, and it's not surprising, but since the times since the 9th century, and beyond, for 1,000 years, when people moved to Israel, their first place that they went was Yerushalayim. It was the focus. Now, the Jewish population in Yerushalayim, until around the 1870s, was pretty small. But as the Aliyot started, the biggest Jewish community in the entire region of the land of Israel was in Yerushalayim. So what was going on, and we'll see in a couple of minutes, what was going on that led to the debate over what to do in Yerushalayim in light of the UN Resolution 181 that happened in Chavtet in November 29th, 1947. Okay, so let's just take a quick look at page 1. We're not going to go through all of this. We're not going to go through every word of the source sheet. I want everybody to have it, though, in case you want to reference it. Biblical Yerushalayim happened 3,000 years ago, about 1,000 before the year of 1,000 before the Common Era. That's when David HaMelech conquers it, establishes it as his capital for the last 30 or so years of his malchut, and his son Shlomo HaMelech builds the Beit HaMikdash, establishing not only the central political power of Am Yisrael, but also the religious center as well in Yerushalayim. That is a moment in time, a critical, pivotal moment in the history of the Jewish people, which is, gave us, for the first time, a national capital. We had religious capitals before, right? The Mishkan went to a number of different places from the entrance of Bnei Israel into Eretz Israel in the times of Yoshua for the next several centuries. But for the first time, we actually had a national and religious capital. And that is what has been, right, in the minds of the Jewish people for, since. During Malchut Yehuda, Yerushalayim remained as the capital of the Jewish people, but eventually, as we know, the Jewish people lost control over the over Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim by default as well. So you just look through these periods, all right? From 1000 till for about 500 years, Am Yisrael was an independent nation living with Yerushalayim as its capital. Babel comes along and destroys the temple. We spoke of the Beit HaMikdash, the first Beit HaMikdash, and Bnei Yisrael go into exile. We spoke about this in the Zionism lectures, but eventually people start coming back, and even though we had control over Yerushalayim in a religious sense, and we were able to reestablish it as the religious center of the country, we didn't have political autonomy. During the first half of the Beit Sheni period, the first two-thirds of the Beit Sheni period, we were the clients of foreign powers. And that's what happened until the time of the Chashmonaim, when there was a revolt against the Hellenistic leadership, and the Chashmonaim, all right, against Greece, and the Chashmonaim then to take over. So then, for the period of 141 before the Common Era till 63 before the Common Era, about 140 years before the destruction of the Second Beit HaMikdash, right? So for that 100-year period of Beit Sheni, that was the last time that we had full political and religious autonomy centered in Yerushalayim. The Roman general Pompey captures Yerushalayim in 63 before the Common Era, and then that was essentially the last time that we had political control. We remained, if 63 BCE, so you see, we have 63 and then another 70 years. So it's, you know, about 130 years from when we lost political control that we still had the religious center of the Beit HaMikdash. But then we lose that, and then from that period of 70, from the year 70 until 1948, Yerushalayim was not any kind of central focal point of any Jewish nation, because we didn't have a state, and it was a place that we dive into every single day, and it of course is featured prominently in Tanakh and in Chazal and in every piece of religious literature that it subsequently happened, every major piece of Jewish literature for 2,000 years. But from the point of 70, of the year 70 until 1948, there was no central location, be it religious, be it political, in Yerushalayim. So, going through all these periods from the Roman conquest, where Yerushalayim was actually raised and renamed because of the Bar Kokhba revolt. It was renamed Aelia Capitolina, which is the capital city. Yerushalayim is then part of this Roman state, going through several periods: the Byzantine period, the Muslim conquest in 638, and then going through within the Crusade, which they then take control for about 400 years until the Crusaders take over, and then there was the Arab, Islam then wins back, and then the Crusaders try and get it back, and then there's this jockeying that's going on, and then it's now under Islamic rule, which is official religious Islamic rule until the Ottoman period began in 1517. That's when the Ottoman Empire comes and controls Yerushalayim, and they take it over, and they now have control over it for the next 500 years. Right, in 1517, 1917, at the end of World War I, the British have as part of a large campaign in the Middle East, capture Yerushalayim and the rest of it, and the predecessor to the United Nations, right? The League of Nations, the predecessor of the United Nations, gives the mandate of the entire land of Israel to the British, and that's what existed from 1917 until 1948. All right, boundaries, borders, these are all fascinating pieces of history. France and Britain basically carved up the Middle East after World War I, and each took a section, and the official policy was that they were mandates. They were supposed to be governed and ruled by the foreign powers, by France and Britain, and the idea was that it's a trusteeship. They're going to oversee the land, and eventually the land is going to be self-ruled by the people that live there, by the indigenous peoples. That was something that wasn't developing and wasn't happening, and that leads us to that period. Then leads us to the lead up to the war of 1948. Okay, so what happens? All right, we all this is a history that many of us, I'm sure, are very familiar with. The Jewish population is from the 1870s through post World War II. Jewish population is constantly increasing, And to at a certain point, it was very much to the Arabs' dismay. Originally, it was done done much better, and then in the 1920s, that's when things start to get really ugly. When Zionism, just as Zionism starts to pick up real steam after the Balfour Declaration under Jewish rule, Balfour Declaration of 1917, in which the British government recognized the right and the right of the Jewish people to a national homeland in the land of Israel, and which they committed themselves to actually endeavor towards reaching that goal. That happened in 1917. From that point on, the Arabs started to get really testy, all right? And there was a huge tension between the Arab population and the Jewish population in the land of Israel for the next 30 years until the establishment of the state of Israel. Okay, what led to all of this? We were, all right, in the previous lectures, we were talking about the philosophy and the ideology behind Zionism. That source number one, which I'll get to in a second, I just wanted to take one little snippet of where Yerushalayim factors in. And that was our introductory remarks. The mass immigration to Israel. Okay, so let's take a look at source one right now. Our goal this morning is not just the history of Medinat Yisrael, but where Yerushalayim fits in Medinat Yisrael. So let's take a look. Source number one is Hatikva. All right? Anybody ever think about where the poem comes from? Everybody ever think about where the national anthem of the United States comes from, the Star Spangled Banner? Francis Scott Keyes, and what he wrote it for? So it's a really fascinating history, not for now. The Hatikva is really the story behind it is fascinating. We don't have time for it right now. Now, Naftali Herzenber, who was a poet, he was born in Ukraine, and he was an early Zionist, and he wrote this poetic expression of the yearning for the land of Israel by the Jewish people. And it was in the first Zionist Congress already in 1897, you know, chaired by Herzl. This one of the things that they did, that they adopted, was the official anthem of the Zionist Congress was going to be this poem, a modified version of this poem by Naftali Herzenber. This was written in 1877, I believe, yes. The after Hakamat HaMedina, one of the first issues that the Knesset took up was establishing a national anthem, and they chose this poem, again, a modified version. So let's take a look at the text that we all are familiar with. Kol od balevav pnima, nefesh Yehudi homia. As long as in the heart within a Jewish soul still yearns, ulafatem mizrach kadima ayin letzion sofia, and onward towards the ends of the east, an eye still gazes towards Zion. It's really one long sentence. Right? As long as the Jewish heart has existed, we've always looked towards Zion. Od lo avdati kvatenu, right? And our hope has not been lost. Hatikva bat shnot apayim, the 2,000-year-old hope that we had. Liyot am chovshi biartzenu eretz Tzion v'Yerushalayim, to be a free nation in our land, the land of Tzion and Yerushalayim. Okay, so the already in the national anthem of the state of Israel, we've named Yerushalayim as the part of the, you know, the great yearning of the Jewish people, not just the land, but eretz Tzion v'Yerushalayim, the land. Zion and Yerushalayim, with Yerushalayim at its center. Okay? Now, once we'll see in a second when we start to appreciate what was going on in Hakamat HaMedina about Yerushalayim, the fact that they adopted this text as their national anthem was not coincidental. All right, let's take a look at source number two. It's actually not the original text that Naftali Herzenber wrote. First of all, it's a 10-stanza poem. Okay, and we only use the first stanza and the refrain. The second verse of Od Lo Avdat Tikvatenu is the refrain that every stanza you're supposed to go read Od Lo Avdat Tikvatenu. The text of the refrain was a little bit different in Ember's original version. Od Lo Avdat Tikvatenu, Hatikva Hanoshna. Right. So we in the version that was adopted, it was changed to Batshnot Alpayim, not. We actually, I mean, say what you want poetically, but the ancient hope is less specific. The version that was adopted by Israel, right, as the national anthem, names a number of years that we've been in exile. It's linking it to exile, not just an ancient hope. All right, Lashuv, and what did Imber write? Lashuv le'eretz avotenu, to return to the land of our fathers, le'ir ba David chana, the city where David encamped. Okay, now, David HaMelech encamped in a number of places. All right, the obvious, I would say, that to us who are familiar with Tanakh, the obvious implication by Imber's citation here, by Imber's line, is a reference to Yerushalayim. Anybody want to disagree? But it could be interpreted, all right, poetically. Let's think as a poet, right? At least as an interpreter of poetry. It could be interpreted by somebody reading this as something referring to other Yerushalayim. Let's say you were an anti-Zionist, right? Let's say you were somebody who wanted to delegitimize the state of Israel's claim to Yerushalayim. You'd open up a Tanakh. You'd write the Jewish Bible. You'd look at every place that the King David encamps that isn't Jerusalem, and say, "Look at me. Maybe that's what it's referring to." So, I'm actually not. I once read a history of the development of Hatikva. I don't remember. At some point, this was changed. I don't know if it was changed by the Zionist Congress or 50 years later by the Knesset. But at some point, this was changed, and the language was changed to much more specific, a less poetic Eretz Tzion Yerushalayim. Right, to linguists here, right, this poetry is generally understood to be more profound, more beautiful if it's, you know, if it's unspecific but implies something, but it can be interpreted in a certain way. I mean, it's less poetic and more specific, but what it was naming unambiguously Yerushalayim as the center of the Tikva Bat Shnot Alpayim, the 2,000-year-old hope for the Jewish people to establish a state. So. This is not, again, I think Imber was unquestionably referring to Yerushalayim. The fact that here we took whatever the possible ambiguity away from this discussion and inserted what we did, right? Already I think kind of gets to this point. All right, and that is, what was the significance of naming Yerushalayim as the capital of Medinat Israel? What do you think? Why did it need to be? Other than the fact that it was an enormous Jewish population, right? So I mean, it's part of this discussion that we've had, right? That we've been having, the importance of but this is the original. This is Imber, and this is the original napkin that he wrote the
Prona.
Yeah. So that's page one. That's the early history of Yerushalayim. It classically was in the time of Malchut David. It was the religious and political center of the land of Israel. The Tikva Bat Shnot Alpayim that we refer to is to go to Eretz Tzion of Yerushalayim to establish that place. Ben Gurion was not a very religious man.
Not that
easy.
What? Not that easy.
Ben Gurion was not a religious man, okay? Ben Gurion used the concept of historical religion assiduously, though. He wasn't much of a believer, and his vision of the state wasn't much of a religious one. But what he did see, he had a lot of respect for the history of religion, the religion sustaining the Jewish people. Yeah, he thought the Medina would be the new religion. He thought that secular Zionism, nationalism, would be more important for sustaining the Jewish people now in the 20th century and beyond. But he would always talk about how at the center of prayer of the Jewish people for thousands of years was Yerushalayim. So for that ideology of Zionism to establish a state and not have Yerushalayim be part of it, was anathema. It couldn't happen. It was incomprehensible.
Just if I could interject, you know, when you read all these talking points, they mention the numerous times that Yerushalayim is mentioned in Jewish scripture, and I think it's like 675 times. Mm-hmm. And by contrast, apparently Yerushalayim is not mentioned in the Quran at all.
Yeah.
That's an important point, because it's not political, you know.
Yeah, so... we'll get into this in a minute, but this is, you know, therein is where lies the like I said before the jockeying between the different sides. We didn't have right in halacha, right? There's different types of chazakot. What establishes your ownership or your jurisdiction over a piece of land? So there's the fact that you're there. And then there can be deeds, legal ownership, right? The Arabs will always claim that they have the chazaka because they were there, right?
Jews never left Jerusalem, no matter how much you exile.
Yeah,
there's always somebody
and then the Jews would counter. There's always been some continuous Jewish presence in Jerusalem, yeah. But the Jewish presence in Jerusalem was tenuous, and I mean that's something that we can't deny. It was tiny and it was tenuous, and it was unquestionably part of our liturgy and part of our emotional connection to the land. But the Arabs will claim, right, who cares, right? There was also, there was lots of things that have been in Yerushalayim for a long time. That doesn't give you the right. We have the chazakah, right? We have the established right of being here.
Plus, of course,
yeah, go ahead, yeah, I'm sorry.
I was going to say that apparently in the 19 years, no Arabs head of state ever came to visit Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And
so,
obviously the attraction only. So they were only attracted after they didn't.
Let's read the Ben Gurion makes a lot of these arguments in some speeches that he gives. That I want to actually read the original text. So let's do that. Can I borrow a watch from somebody because I left mine at home? Thanks. So let's jump right into it. Okay. So what happens? The UN establishes a commission to figure out what to do about this intractable question. Right? The Arabs and the Jews are at each other's throats. Yerushalayim is a big part of it, but it's not by no means the only part of it. There's a whole issue. So they established this commission for UNSCOP, the UN commission on what to do about Palestine, and they go through. They spend months researching the issue, interviewing both sides. One of the things I brought it here. I very very much recommend this book if you want to understand a lot of the basics of the stuff leading up to the Hakamat Hamdina. And what followed during the war, and then a part of the political process that led after it. This is not without some controversy in Benny Morris's book, 1948. But I'll just laying out the facts. This is a really really good, very well done, easy to read, put together history of this period. So I can't recommend it enough. Benny Morris. So. The UN after this fact finding mission presents its plan. All right, what is the plan? All right, I put a little part of it. Some of this I wanted to look at the primary texts today to the extent that we could. So, all right, so this is the famous UN resolution 181 adopted that was voted on November 29th, 1947. All right, so here we go. So part one, future and constitution and government of Palestine. So part one, section A, termination of mandate, partition and independence. This is source number three on page two. All right, number one of source number three. The mandate for Palestine shall terminate as soon as possible, but in any case, not later than August 1st, 1948. All right, so the British, the first part of the Palestine of Resolution 181, that the British are going to get out. Okay, they were they jumped the gun. They said August 1st at the latest. British left in May. In May of 1948. Again, this is think of the timeline. This is November of 47. So they were saying that you have until a little bit less than a year, right? You have about 10 months for the British to make plans to get out. They got out by May. Independent Arab and Jewish states and the special international regime for the city of Jerusalem set forth in part three of this plan shall come into existence in Palestine 2 months after the evacuation of the armed forces of the mandatory power has been completed, but in any case, not later than October 1st, 1948. Okay, so in August of 48, the British have to leave. By October 1st, 1948, there needs to be an international jurisdiction, a special international regime for the city. The boundaries of the Arab state, the Jewish state, and the city of Jerusalem shall be as described in parts 2 and 3 below. All right, so what was the partition plan? The partition plan was to take the land of Israel and split it into an Arab state and a Jewish state. You've seen the map. I could have put it on here, but I'm sure we're familiar with the map of what the partition plan was. Yerushalayim was known by this term of the corpus separatum. It was supposed to be this international regime, a special international regime, to use the word of the resolution. Okay, let's just read what the special regime. Resolution 181 is a very long document. I just took a couple of snippets. Okay, so let's go to part three, special regime. The city of Jerusalem shall be established as a corpus separatum under a special international regime and shall be administered by the United Nations. A trusteeship council shall be designated to discharge the responsibilities of the administering authority on behalf of the United Nations. Okay, so this was the resolution. The resolution called for two separate states, but the status of Yerushalayim was to be an international one. Why? Because it was at the heart of the debate, Yerushalayim. The Jews couldn't live without it, and the Arabs also had no interest in relinquishing one inch of Yerushalayim. It was the center, it was the religious focal point of the entire land, and there was hundreds of thousands of people living in the vicinity of the city that whose fate needed to be decided. The problem was that Yerushalayim was in the center, in the middle of this what was supposed to be an Arab state. And while the goal of the partition was for these two states living peacefully side by side with one another, there was going to be the fate of this city in the middle of the Arab state with a huge Jewish population and important Jewish holy places needed to be determined. So this was the solution of the Resolution 181, is you guys get to have two separate states, but we're not letting you have Yerushalayim. Neither of you are allowed to have Jerusalem. That's going to remain ours. We're going to be in charge of it. Okay, so we all know to some extent, we're familiar with the history that followed. In 1947, after the resolution vote of November 29th, pretty much the next day, a civil war broke out. The civil war was between the local Arab populations living in what was to be Medinat Israel, right, living in this area, and the Jewish populations. All right, and it was extremely tense and difficult to manage this period. Because officially, the Haganah, Eitz HaLechi, all of these military organizations were still illegal. Because they were still under the British mandate until they officially left in May. So for these several months, they had to fight a civil war against these attacking Arab bands that the British did not do much. They didn't go out of their way in most of the cases to mediate, to defend them against. All right? So the Jewish population in the area then starts to mobilize its forces. Already negotiations start happening for arms procurements, and they start getting the makings of their first army with the goal of when the British finally leave in May, they're going to be able to hit the ground running with the organizational structure for a government and an army that they're going to need. Meanwhile, during this time, while they're fighting the civil war, which was brutal and lasted from November till May, while they're fighting the civil war, all of the surrounding Arab countries, all of whom voted against partition, claiming that it was claiming correctly that it was not a possible solution, that the Arab local Arab states, local Arab population will never accept the Jewish state. They weren't wrong. All right, maybe if they weren't talking like that, people actually would have accepted it. You never know. But in fact, what they predicted was what would happen. Right, in at the end of World War II, this is an important historical nugget. At the end of World War II. Late in the game, after the Yalta Conference, where FDR was meeting, he meets on a cruise ship on a carrier with the King of Saudi Arabia, Ibn Saud, and that's when some of the first documentation of U.S. promises to the Arabs not to support a lot of the Zionist aspirations actually took place. During that point, Ibn Saud, this was a private meeting between Roosevelt and Ibn Saud, he says, you can't expect the surrounding Arab population to ever accept the Jewish state. Right? He wasn't jockeying in the UN, he wasn't grandstanding, he was saying privately, and he was correct. This was not a possibility that anybody around in the area was planning on lying down. So during this several month process from November till May, all the surrounding Arab countries are screaming bloody murder. We're going to drive the Jews into the sea. This state of Israel will never take place. The Jewish state will never take place. It wasn't the state of Israel yet, right? It's not going to happen. Partition can't happen. It will never be implemented. No. It never will be. And they actually start gathering their armies and gathering resources for a full-scale invasion of Israel. All right? Now, don't think that all these Arab countries were purely altruistic, that they were fighting on behalf of their Palestinian brethren. That was not the case. Everybody had their own national interest. The only people who didn't have, the only one of these countries that didn't have an interest in this particular land was Lebanon, and that's why Lebanon, if you read the history of the war, Lebanon had virtually no activity during the war. They had a symbolic attack on one little piece of land. They ended up getting only a few hundred yards that they seized of land, a few hundred square yards. It came out nothing. And they did it to save face so that, you know, when the Arab countries met, they would be able to say, we fought in the war also. But they marshaled their army and parked themselves on the border and didn't do much. But, as we know, Egypt very much wanted to maintain the land bridge to Asia. They wanted the Negev. That was in their national interest. The Hashemite kingdom in Jordan, right? So the Hashemites wanted the entire. They didn't want what is today the Yehuda Shomron, what we call the West Bank. They didn't want that. They wanted the entire area from the Yarden to the Mediterranean. Notice, look on a map. Jordan is a landlocked state. It has no maritime access. So they thought not only would we lend legitimacy to the Hashemite kingdom by adding Jerusalem, right, which is an important location in the Arab world, to our kingdom, we would also. It would politically, and for lots of reasons, it would be significant for us to have access to the Mediterranean. So they wanted the entire chunk. Syria and Iraq also, they had their own interests, which is why they committed major military forces to the campaign. So during this period, all these armies are screaming bloody murder, radio waves, you know, cartoons. It's crazy how they were planning to drive the Jewish, you know, what was to be this tiny Jewish state into the sea. And they never did, all right, because while this was all happening, the Jewish agency, the Haganah, Eitz Alechi, they were all planning. It was not the smoothest operation in the world, but they planned for all this process. And by the time the British left, in May of 1948, Israel was ready, essentially. Okay, so what happened? On the day that they left, the big debate was whether or not to declare independence. Okay, and for another time, but we all know that in the end, they chose to declare independence. Now, I didn't put it here, but because there is nothing really to say, but you'll notice that in the Israel's original Declaration of Independence, there was no talk of boundaries. And it was debated in different drafts of the declaration. They were saying maybe we should refer to the partition boundaries, we want to be partitioned. But Ben-Gurion didn't want to do that because he knew that they were about to be attacked, and he knew that they were the boundaries outlined by the resolution, by the 181, were not defendable, right? They were indefensible boundaries. And they were, what was going to happen? They had this organized army. He had every confidence that they were able to push back into further territory, seize further territory, and be able to expand the borders. So if they put limiting boundaries in their Declaration of Independence, they were going to miss their opportunity to do all of those things subsequently. Also, they wanted Yerushalayim. And it was a big, big part of, for all the reasons that we were talking about, it was a huge part of what they were. Now, Yerushalayim, interestingly, doesn't feature in the Declaration of Independence. They don't mention it. They mention the importance of Jewish history, the prophets of Israel, how we have an uninterrupted connection to this land, our historical right, our moral right, our political right. That mentions all of that, doesn't mention Yerushalayim. It doesn't mention any location. Again, not by coincidence. Because they were planning on getting Yerushalayim, but officially the world policy when they declared independence was that Yerushalayim was not part of Israel, or what was not part of what was going to be the Jewish state. And if they declared Yerushalayim, then they could be seen as the aggressor. So they mentioned no location, just the right of the land, and it was on this land. That was where they declared independence. Right? This Medina, right? Anu machrizim bazot, that this is going to be the Medina Yehudit, that's going to be Medina Yisrael. And then, immediately, that day, the Jordan and Egyptian armies invade. And immediately they start fighting a bitter, bitter war from May till pretty much the end of the year. Eventually, all right, and again, I encourage you to read Morris's book, but immediately what happened was that there was an arms embargo in the Middle East. Nobody was allowed to procure shipments of weapons. Now, the thing that worked very much to the Jews' advantage, because they would never had a legal army. Right? They never had an official army. They always had an illegal army. The Jews in what was then the State of Israel, well, finally was now the State of Israel, were very adept at procuring arms in an illegal way. And that's what they did. They were good at it. They knew how to talk. It helped that they had Judaism, right? And this is another advantage that they had. There are Jews all over the world. So that they had well-connected people in all over the place. The Arab states did not have that connection. The other thing that was hugely significant was the fact that the Jewish people, while their home base was thousands of miles away, it was an affluent and very committed base. Right? The story goes: the Golda Meir basically came to America to raise money for the war, and she basically walked into every Jewish community in the country with a pushka over several months. Every time I see a shul that's been around for 60, 70 years, I always just picture Golda Meir, you know, like a little bag lady, you know, there with a pushka. But she was on a fundraising mission, and that's what she did. I don't remember the numbers offhand. I should have written them down. I think Ben-Gurion told her that she needs to go and raise $15 million if we want to stay in the army, and she got 100. Right, she came back with 100 million in a fraction of the time that she was setting out to go. So another big part of the advantage that the Jews had in this war was that they had even if it was far away, they had financial, political, material support that the Arabs could not have. They knew how to work around the system because they had been doing it for so long, and that's what they did. The other piece of to the advantage was that the world was full post World War II was full of weaponry that nobody was using. So, I mean, as much as many weapons as the as they managed to get into Israel, that's how many that, that we were not able to get in. But as the war went on, they were also getting more and more recruits. Again, think about it. They established a state. So immediately upon Hakamat HaMedina, they took control over the borders, and they were finally able to admit refugees. But the hundreds of thousands of people that were trying to get in for years that couldn't, overnight they were able to. So they were recruiting new members of their army the entire time during the war. The army swelled to several times its original size by the end of the war than it was at the beginning. Their arms stores, several times the size that they were at the beginning of the war. While the Arab states, they were trying to fight a war in a foreign country, right? Soldiers in a foreign country eventually lose their luster for fighting a war. They were running out of materials, they were running out of supplies, and there was an arms embargo in the Middle East that they didn't know how to get around. It was costing them money that they didn't have. Right? So all of these factors contributing meant that while at the beginning of the war there was this huge threat, by the end of the war, Israel actually really did have the upper hand militarily. That is what led to the armistice agreements in 1949. Right? So they negotiated the armistice agreements, which Israel had high hopes for you know, leading to eventual full-scale peace treaties. The agreements themselves are really, they're hysterical documents, if you look at them. The way in which the Arab states were trying to say, we're not fighting and we're acknowledging this being a boundary, but there's not a chance that we would ever really acknowledge this as a boundary, even though it's a boundary. We're not going to consider it a boundary, even though it's a boundary. And everybody should just know that we have every intention of blowing up Israel, you know, at a future date. But for now, this is the boundary at which we will stop trying to. All right, so I'm paraphrasing. The point is that the armistice agreements each arrived at, and each one was political mastery of the highest order, and each one was different. There were different issues there. All right, the easiest one was Lebanon for the reasons like I told you. There wasn't much going on. Egypt was the first, and Lebanon, and then Jordan, and then Syria and Iraq refused to negotiate with them. But they didn't border Israel, so there wasn't a big deal. Okay, we get to the armistice process. Now, the armistice agreements that are happening with Jordan, those are the ones that are relevant for us because we're discussing Yerushalayim right now. Okay, so now, what's going on in the world? The UN had decided in November of 47 that it's going to be an international trusteeship, this international body, international regime, in the text of 181, that was going to be for Yerushalayim. The Jews wanted it as their capital. The Arabs, the Hashemites, didn't want it as their capital. They just wanted the entire area. But they also, now they're starting to use the Palestinian card. They're saying, okay, there were all these local Arab populations, and now they deserve, they deserve this land because it's theirs. So that's when the first time that we actually see this idea in this period in history. It's the first time that we ever see this idea of Jerusalem being any type of capital in the Arab world. Okay? Let's take a look over here. I took a small section of the armistice agreement signed on April 3rd, 1949. The armistice agreement started in January with Egypt. Egypt took about 6 weeks, and then they went to Lebanon, which took less time. And then by March they were negotiating with Jordan. Okay, we're at the bottom of page number 2. The special committee shall be organized immediately following the coming into effect of this agreement, and shall direct its attention to the formulation of agreed plans and arrangements for such matters, as either party may submit to it, which in any case shall include the following on which agreement in principle already exists. Right? So what interpretation? They're going to have a committee. This is part of the, they discuss boundaries, and then they're going to figure out what they're going to do about a number of issues that were outstanding. So they left a number of issues unresolved with Jordan. And they said, we're going to establish a committee, and we have principal agreements on all these, but we don't have signed agreements. So we're going to establish a committee, and these are the issues that we're going to debate. We're going to discuss. We're going to finalize. Free movement of traffic on vital roads. All right? We're going to be able to actually have movements. There's going to be a border, but there's going to be a border crossing. We're actually going to be able to have free movement of traffic, including the Bethlehem and Latrun Jerusalem roads. Right? Basically, they were saying that eventually Jordan and Israel were going to allow each other to drive on their countries. Resumption of normal functioning of the cultural and humanitarian institutions on Mount Scopus. What was on Mount Scopus? Right, Hebrew University, which was shut down. So Jordan officially agreed to the allowance of, within their territory, of Hebrew U continuing, and free access thereto, and allowing any Jew who wants to get to Hebrew U to get there. Free access to the holy places and cultural institutions, and use of the cemetery on the Mount of Olives. All right, resumption of operations of this Latrun pumping station, provision of electricity for the old city, and a resumption of operation to the railroad of Jerusalem. Originally, all of these things were going to be agreed upon. They just they couldn't sign yet. This didn't end up happening. But officially, according to the armistice agreements, there was supposed to be an agreement that Jews were supposed to have free access to the old city. If that ever actually happened, the justification for taking the old city would have been significantly diminished. But as we know, what developed was there were two parties. While the governments might have been willing participants, the populace was not. Right, the two populations were not. And what eventually happened was that it was Kielu. Right, it was like what happened in Berlin during the Cold War. It was a wall went up, and you weren't allowed to cross it. There was a no man's land in between. And if somebody was crossing from west to east Jerusalem, they got shot. That's what ended up happening in reality. But officially, according to the armistice, there was supposed to be this connection. Now, this was very much under protest at the time. They agreed to this. The UN, this was mediated by the UN, the Jordan-Israel Peace Treaty, right, by Ralph Bunche, who took over for Folke Bernadotte, who was originally the UN mediator in the area, and he was assassinated by Lehi assassins, and really at the very beginning of the process in 48, and.
Well,
so,
Baer,
what?
He was the Baer.
Bernadotte was assassinated. No, he was shot. All right, we'll discuss it another time. But Bernadotte was the UN. I mean, this is actually part of the history that I wasn't taught when I was a kid. But the Jewish soldiers actually assassinated the UN, the head of the UN mission in Israel. Bunche, who is his successor, is officially mediating these discussions. But a lot of what was ended up being agreed upon would happen secretly in a different spot, and then they secretly met and secretly agreed to these things, and then they would come ostensibly where Bunche was mediating, and then they kind of laid out what they had already agreed to. That was a big part of the duplicitous process during where we allowed the UN. See, the thing is, Jordan really wanted Yerushalayim and really wanted this land for themselves. They wanted the UN out as much as they wanted. They didn't want this international regime any more than the Jews did. So what ended up happening was they had this idea of splitting Yerushalayim down the middle, which is what we now know today as West and East Jerusalem. They split Yerushalayim down the middle. The Jews were going to take their one half, and the Jordanians were going to take their half, and the Jordanians were, and everybody was going to coexist as long as they guaranteed free access, as long as they guaranteed access to Hebrew U, right? That was Hebrew U was going to be this little enclave of part of the Jewish state that was surrounded by the Arab state, and in principle, that's how it was supposed to work. Okay, UN did not like this plan. And immediately the UN starts submitting reports about how they wanted this plan resolved. What they did not want was a split down the middle. They liked this idea of the corpus separatum, and they couldn't get away from it. If you're thinking, right, if this is the idea of an idea that was proposed a long time ago and doesn't work and didn't work and is continuing to not work, if the idea of that is ringing a bell to you, but nevertheless still being pushed over and over and over again by mediating parties, if that's ringing a bell to you, it makes sense, because this is what was going on already here. The UN, even though Jordan and Israel had agreed to this principal agreement, the UN didn't like it, and they wanted the corpus separatum reinstituted. Okay, so what's happening? December, so this was in April of 49, they signed the armistice agreement. In December, all right, this is 8 months later. So there's a lot of stuff going on here. This is when the armistice wasn't really working out. So in December, the UN is now meeting to discuss the fate of the future of Yerushalayim. On the eve of that discussion, Ben-Gurion gives a speech in the Knesset. And very publicly, he knew it was going to get covered by the press, and he knew what was going to happen. And he lays out the plan for Yerushalayim. Again, in terms of the international view, the issue of Yerushalayim was not settled, which is why the UN was debating it. Source number 5, page 3. This is a speech Ben-Gurion gave. Let's try and get through as much of it as we can. As you know, again, this is on the eve of discussing Yerushalayim. The UN, as you know, the UN is currently discussing the issue of Jerusalem and the holy places. The State of Israel is a member of the UN, not because of political convenience, but because of its traditional, deep-seated commitment to the vision of world peace and brotherhood of nations, as preached by our prophets and accepted by the UN. This membership obliges us, from the podium of Israel's first Knesset, to tell all the nations assembled at the UN and all those who love peace and justice in the world what has been in Israel's heart since it became a united nation under King David 3,000 years ago as regards Jerusalem, its holy city, and as regards its attitudes to the places which are holy to other religions. When we proclaimed the establishment of the renewed state of Israel on May 14, 1948, we declared that the state of Israel will guarantee freedom of religion and conscience, of language, education, and culture. It will safeguard the holy places of all religions. It will be loyal to the principles of the United Nations Charter. Accordingly, our delegation to the UN announced that Israel would honor all the existing rights regarding the holy places and sacred buildings in Jerusalem, assure freedom of worship and free access to all the holy sites under its control, recognizing the rights of pilgrims, notice they didn't have control over the old city here, recognizing the rights of pilgrims of all religions and nations to visit their holy places and assuring freedom of movement for clergymen. We agreed to allow effective UN supervision of the holy places and the existing rights in a way that would be agreed to between Israel and the United Nations. Now, originally, Ben-Gurion was offering that the UN would manage not the city, but just the holy places. The holy places, which are at the center of this debate, the UN would have this trusteeship just over the holy places. So, in the original plan, the UN would have Har HaBayis. They would have the Kotel. That was the idea. At the same time, we see fit to state that Jewish Jerusalem is an organic, inseparable part of the state of Israel. This is the fourth paragraph. Just as it is an integral part of Jewish history and belief, Jerusalem is the heart of the state of Israel. We are proud of the fact that Jerusalem is also sacred to other religions. We will gladly provide access to their holy places and enable them to worship as and where they please, cooperating with the UN, the UN to guarantee this. We cannot imagine, however, that the UN would attempt to sever Jerusalem from the state of Israel or harm Israel's sovereignty and its eternal capital. Right? The language here is very specific. Ben-Gurion was saying that we want Israel as part of our capital, and he's stating that it's their capital, it's eternal capital. The only thing that we could use the UN's help with, and is what we would like them to partner with us on, is guaranteeing safety and security of holy places so that we can ensure free access. Twice in history, paragraph 5, twice in the history of our nation, we were driven out of Jerusalem only after being defeated in bitter wars by the larger, stronger forces of Babylon and Rome. Our links with Jerusalem today are no less deep than in the days of Nebuchadnezzar and Titus Flavius. And when Jerusalem was attacked after the 14th of May, 1948, like I said, invaded by the Jordanian army, our valiant youngsters risked their lives for our sacred capital no less than our forefathers did in the time of the First and Second Temples. A nation that, for 2,500 years, has faithfully adhered to the vow made by the first exiles by the waters of Babylon, not to forget Yerushalayim, Mishkachach Yerushalayim Tishkach Imini, will never agree to be separated from Jerusalem. Jewish Jerusalem will never accept alien rule after thousands of its youngsters liberated their historic homeland for the third time, redeeming Jerusalem from destruction and vandalism. We do not judge the UN, which did nothing when nations, which were members of the UN, declared war on its resolution of November 29, 1947, trying to prevent the establishment of Israel by force, to annihilate the Jewish population in the Holy Land and destroy Jerusalem, the holy city of the Jewish people. He's shaming the UN here. How much chutzpah do you have? You declared Resolution 181. Several member states then declared war on us and, by extension, on the resolution, and you did nothing. We don't blame you for that. That's okay. We handled ourselves. Had we not been able to withstand the aggressor, second to last paragraph on page 3, who rebelled against the UN, again, now he's talking about partition as the UN. They rebelled against the UN. They didn't attack Israel. They rebelled against the UN. Had we not been able to withstand the aggressor who rebelled against the UN, Jewish Jerusalem would have been wiped off the face of the earth. The Jewish population would have been eradicated, and the state of Israel would not have arisen. Thus, we are no longer morally bound by the UN resolution of November 29th. Since the UN was unable to implement it, in our opinion, the decision of November 29th regarding Jerusalem is null and void. So it's fascinating, the nuanced approach that he was taking to 181. On the one hand, the Declaration of Independence in Israel established the whole justification for Israel's existence as being the international recognition as seen in 181. But he's saying that 181, parts, big chunks of 181 are now null and void because the UN did nothing did nothing to enforce it. The attempt to sever Jewish Jerusalem, last paragraph, from the state of Israel will not advance the cause of peace in the Middle East or in Jerusalem itself. Israelis will give their lives to hold on to Jerusalem, just as the British would for London, the Russians for Moscow, and the Americans for Washington. Top of page 4. This is the first time in this country's history that the state controlling Jerusalem willingly accepts the principle of the international supervision of the holy places. It is no coincidence that it is being done by the nation that made Jerusalem an internationally sacred center and by the first government elected by the inhabitants of Jerusalem. We hope that the religions which honor Jerusalem's sanctity and the nations which share our belief in the principles of peace and justice will honor Israel's rights in Jerusalem, just as Israel honors those of all the religions in its sacred capital and sovereign state. He moved me. All right, so he gives this speech, and it falls in large part on deaf ears. The General Assembly adopts Resolution 303. All right, this is on December 9th. So 4 days earlier was Ben-Gurion's introductory speech. December 9th, it says, basically, we don't have to read it inside, Resolution 303, source 6, is saying that everything that we said in 181 about Jerusalem being corpus separatum needs to be reinstated. So let's do that. Okay? Then Ben-Gurion gives another speech in response to 303. Okay, so everybody with me? 181 was in November 47. Then we have the War of Independence. All right, we have the Civil War, then the War of Independence after the British leave in May of 48. In December of 48, right? There, in April of 48, in April of 49, they had the armistice agreement with Jordan, and then in December of 49, the UN wants to start is debating what's going to happen in Yerushalayim. Ben Gurion gives a speech saying, "We will not leave. It's Jewish, and there's nothing to do about it. We declare it as our capital." Then the UN basically says, "I don't care what you say, Ben Gurion. We're going back to the plan for Yerushalayim in 181. Then Ben-Gurion gives another speech. This is 4 days later. 1 week ago this day, in the name of the government of Israel, I made a statement on Jerusalem before the Knesset. This is in reference to his previous speech. I need hardly to say to you that this statement retains its full force, that no change in our attitude has occurred or can possibly occur. As you know, the General Assembly of the United Nations has, in the meantime, by a large majority, decided to place Jerusalem under an international regime as a separate city. This decision is utterly incapable of implementation. If only for the determined, unalterable opposition of the inhabitants of Jerusalem themselves, how could you establish a government when the governed have absolutely no interest in that government? It is to be hoped that the General Assembly will, in the course of time, correct this mistake, which its majority has made, and will make no attempt whatsoever to impose a regime on the Holy City against the will of its people. We respect, third paragraph, we respect and shall continue to respect the wishes of all those states which are concerned for freedom of worship and free access to the holy places, and which seek to safeguard existing rights in the holy places and religious buildings in Jerusalem. Our undertaking to preserve these rights remains in force, and we shall gladly and willingly carry it out, even though we cannot lend ourselves to take part in the enforced separation of Jerusalem, which violates without need or reason the historic and natural right of the people which dwells in Zion. There's going to be a separation, we can't be involved in that. But we're happy to govern the city. From the very first days of the provincial government, which is what happened before, of the provisional government, which happened before they had the first election, we made the peace. The security and the economic consolidation of Jerusalem, our principal care. In the stress of war when Jerusalem was under siege, we were compelled to establish the seat of government in Hakiriyah by Tel Aviv. They wanted to establish the government in Yerushalayim, but they couldn't. But for the state of Israel, there has always been and always be one capital only, page 5. Jerusalem the Eternal. So it was 3,000 years ago, and so it will be, we believe, until the end of time. As soon as the fighting stopped, we began transferring government offices to Yerushalayim. You have to understand that the UN was debating the fate of Yerushalayim while the moving trucks were actually moving the furniture from the Kiryat in Tel Aviv to Yerushalayim. This was a big, I don't care what you say, right? It's from Ben-Gurion to the international community who was trying to control what they were doing about Yerushalayim. As soon as the fighting stopped, we started moving the government offices, effective communications, economics, and technical arrangements. We are continuing with the transfer of the government to Jerusalem and hope to complete it as soon as possible. When the first Knesset was opened in Jerusalem on the 14th of February 1949, there were no adequate facilities for its normal functioning in the capital, and it was necessary to transfer its sessions temporarily to Tel Aviv. He's responding to an argument by the international community that, what do you mean Jerusalem's your capital? You have your capital in Tel Aviv. You've been meeting in Tel Aviv. He's saying, we were meeting in Yerushalayim to the extent that we were able to. The required arrangements in Jerusalem are on the verge of completion, and there is nothing now to prevent the Knesset from returning to Jerusalem. We propose that you take a decision to this effect. In all these arrangements, there is, of course, nothing that alters in the slightest degree any of the existing rights in the holy places, which the government of Israel will respect in full, and our consents to effective supervision of these holy places by the United Nations, as our delegation to the General Assembly declared. Okay, that is Ben-Gurion's response to 303. Then the trusteeship council issues, right? This is on the 20th, so this previous speech, what was the date on this speech was the 13th. So a week later, the trusteeship council sends a resolution, right? The trusteeship council, this is what Bernadotte and then Bunch was in charge of. It says, we want to basically, it's of the opinion, and right, look at the bottom of Article 1, that the action of the government of Israel is likely to render more difficult the implementation of the Statute of Jerusalem with which the council is entrusted by the General Assembly. All right? Basically ignoring everything that Ben-Gurion is saying and just saying the Israeli government is being intransigent, they're being stubborn, and we're working hard to try and implement 181 still, and what are they doing? Even though Ben-Gurion basically said there's not a chance that we're ever going to implement 181, 181 is null and void. Okay, Abba Ibn then responds, the rest of Source 8 requests a statement in response to a number of reports by Israel's representative at the UN, which was Abba Ibn. Abba Ibn says, my government believes, this is source 9, my government believes that it has full and complete authority, thank you so much, Alana. My government believes that it has the full and complete authority for deciding upon the measures announced in the Knesset on the 17th of December 1949. These measures mark the continuation of a process begun long ago as part of an effort to restore Jerusalem to its traditional place in the life of the country. It will be recalled that the highest organs of the State of Israel, the presidency and the Knesset, were founded and instituted in Jerusalem early in 1949. All right? The argument was that they were there and then they had to leave. Ben-Gurion was saying that was only a practical issue. Even before Israel's admission to membership of the United Nations. The Supreme Court of Israel has always sat in Jerusalem, and several ministries have been working in the city for months past. My government, therefore, fails to understand the grounds for the opinion expressed in the Trusteeships Council resolution that the removal of certain ministries and central departments to Jerusalem is likely to render more difficult the implementation of the Statute of Jerusalem. Basically saying, we don't care about the 181 anymore. The Statute of Jerusalem is ridiculous if you think that we should be implementing it. We're treating the government de facto, de jure, de facto, just in practicality, as our capital. How dare you say otherwise? That was basically his response. Like, what are you talking about? But he said it more eloquently. Okay, let's fast forward 30 years. Let's fast forward 50 years. As we all know, Yerushalayim was established as the capital of the State of Israel. Huge amounts of capital, right? No pun intended. Huge amounts of the country's resources went into establishing Yerushalayim, the beautification of Yerushalayim, government buildings, the Knesset, all of this was happening, yes, for the ideological reasons, but also to show the world that we are not budging on Yerushalayim. And for years and years and years, right, really until today, the status of Yerushalayim has remained internationally a question. Partially because there's a tremendous amount of lobbying in the countries that are anti-Israel to, on the status of Yerushalayim. Even West Yerushalayim, so 67 they reunited. And the country is now reunited. In 1980, under Begin, the Knesset passes the Jerusalem Law, which basically establishes Yerushalayim as an undivided capital, and that any attempt to divide Yerushalayim is going to be illegal. All right, and that's that. I wanted to add one more document here, which is just you should read the whole thing because if ever there, the U.S.-Israel relationship, at times is very frustrating, but at times is really very heartwarming. I wasn't able to go. My brother, who's a rabbi of a different shul, was on NORPAC a couple weeks ago, and he came back telling me, he's like, just the U.S.-Israel relationship is just fascinating. He was meeting with members of Congress, who I don't know if anybody's ever been on NORPAC, who were just gushing, couldn't get out enough praise for Israel and enough of enough expressions about how committed they are to Israel's security, Israel's peace, Israel's prosperity. 1995, Congress passes a law, which is absolutely fascinating. Congress passes a law in which which demands that the U.S. actually recognize Yerushalayim as Israel's capital. Something that several countries have done, but many have backed off of. And again, the status today is very much subject to debate in the international community. 1995, Congress passes a law that basically says that the embassy of Jerusalem, which is in Tel Aviv, needs to be moved to Yerushalayim. And it passed with amazing support. I'm sure we all, many of us remember this. So let me just give you the numbers. So the Jerusalem Embassy Act is what it was known as. U.S. Public Law 45, 1995, enacted by the 104th Congress. It passed on the same day, on October 24th, 1995, in the Senate, 93 in favor against 5 opposed. 93-5. In the House, it passed 374 in favor against 37.
But still
is in
Tel Aviv.
It still is in Tel Aviv. But there is a law on the books, in the U.S. law, that actually recognizes Jerusalem as the capital to the extent that we have to move the embassy to Jerusalem. This is a law that's on the books. Now, one of the provisions of the law is that the president has the opportunity to delay its implementation. For for political reasons. He says in terms of in the interest of the national security of the people. That is that's the presidential waiver. Every 6 months, the presidential waiver needs to be signed. Clinton signed the presidential waiver, and 6 months after this law was passed in November of 95, and it has been subsequently signed every 6 months by every president, by Clinton, and then Bush, right, and then now by Obama. Every 6 months. Right? So now we have Republican and Democratic presidents alike that have been signing a presidential waiver every 6 months. Read just a couple of the things from this. They had a fact-finding mission in which Congress was writing this law. This is amazing. One, all right, this is 10 and we'll finish with this. Each sovereign nation under international law and custom may designate its own capital. Since 1950, the city of Jerusalem has been the capital of the state of Israel. Three, the city of Jerusalem is the seat of Israel's president, parliament, and Supreme Court. Think about the controversy over some of these statements in the international community. That the U.S. Congress was able to pass this law overwhelmingly with these types of statements is really something else. City of Jerusalem is the seat of Israel's president, parliament, Supreme Court, and the site of numerous government ministries and social and cultural institutions. Four, the city of Jerusalem is the spiritual center of Judaism and is also considered a holy city by members of other religious faiths. Five, from 1948 to 1967, Jerusalem was a divided city, and Israeli citizens of all faiths, as well as Jewish citizens of all states, were denied access to the holy sites in the area controlled by Jordan. Six, in 1967, the city of Jerusalem was reunited during the conflict known as the Six-Day War. That name for the war would never, never make it into U.S. legislation today, because that's what Israel called the war. They didn't call it that in the Arab states. So it would either be the Six-Day War or they would probably call it the June 1967 War, Arab-Israeli War. That's probably the way it would be. But they called it the Six-Day War in 95. So, number seven, 1967. Jerusalem has been a united city administered by Israel, and persons of all religions, faiths have been guaranteed full access to the holy sites within the city. 15. All right, I'm skipping a little bit here. So Article 15. The United States maintains its embassy in the functioning capital of every country, except in the case of our democratic friend and strategic ally, the State of Israel. 16. The United States conducts official meetings and other business in the city of Jerusalem. We're already using it as the de facto recognition of its status as the capital of Israel. How could we be meeting with government leaders in Jerusalem and not have it not be the capital? 17. In 1996, the State of Israel will celebrate the 3,000th anniversary of the Jewish presence in Jerusalem since King David's entry, which was what precipitated this law in the first place. So Section 3, the timetable sets out that they have to move the embassy, and Section 7, which is the presidential waiver, says that the president every 6 months needs to sign a waiver until such time as this law can be implemented. What the future of Yerushalayim and the international community is, I guess, an open question. But the State of Israel remains, as we all do, to the commitment of a united Yerushalayim. And as much as there was political debate, political jockeying, and really just a fascinating history of back and forth between Ben-Gurion and the early founders of the State of Israel, along with the international community and the United Nations, despite that, the facts on the ground remain that the Yerushalayim is the undivided capital of the State of Israel, of Medina Israel, and of Artsinu HaKadosha. We pray that it will remain so for all time, for all eternity. And with that, I thank you very much, everybody. I wish you a Yom Yerushalayim Sameach.